Welcome to the Voices in Bioethics podcast. My name is Randy Fain. I'm a physician and a graduate of the Columbia University Master's in Bioethics program. It is my great pleasure today to have Diane Button and Sarah Hill as my guests. Diane is a best-selling author, a doula instructor, and founding partner of the Bay Area End of Life Doula Alliance, which is called ELDA. Years ago, when Diane's grandfather died in her arms, he had a gigantic smile on his face. He lived and he died in peace. Diane has spent decades seeking to understand how he did that so beautifully. Her books include Dear Death, Finding Meaning in Life, Peace in Death and Joy in an Ordinary Day, and a doula training manual that she co-authored called The Doula Toolkit. She's a frequent contributor to Maria Shriver's Sunday Paper, and she's currently writing a book called What Matters Most for Maria's imprint called The Open Field. There she'll share the many profound lessons the dying have taught her about living. Sarah is an end-of-life doula with East Bay Doula for the Dying, where she provides support to those who are dying and their constellation of caregivers. She's been interested in this work since childhood and ultimately pivoted from being a change management consultant in the corporate sector to being an end-of-life doula in her 40s. The major life choice allowed her to exchange achievement for fulfillment. In addition to her private practice, Sarah is a member of the Bay Area End-of-Life Doula Alliance. Welcome, Diane and Sarah. Thank you so much for being here. I'd like to talk to you today about the growing movement to demedicalize death and the emerging role of end-of-life doulas in supporting dying people and their families who are seeking a more humane end-of-life experience. I think that medical technology, along with a Western mentality that views death as something to avoid at all costs, have led us to a society where people are mostly dying in hospitals, where death oftentimes can be prolonged, but not necessarily life or quality of life. So I think that the introduction of hospice and palliative care medicine are changing this, and end-of-life doulas are becoming an integral part of the death experience. But still, I think a lot of people are not aware of who death doulas are, what they do, and how to find one. So let's dive into that. I'll start with you, Sarah, and ask you if you can give us an overview of what exactly an end-of-life doula is and what they do.
Sure, Randy. And on behalf of Diane and myself, thanks so much for having us here. Talking about the work of the end-of-life doula is our joy. And so we appreciate having an opportunity to do so. So an end-of-life doula is somebody that provides emotional, psychological, spiritual support to somebody who is dying and what I call the constellation of care around them. So that could be family, it could be friends, it could be an amalgamation of the two, chosen family, but whomever is around the person who is dying, we're there to be containers for the experience that they're having. I like to kind of break down the doula work into three parts. It's the work of the head, the work of the hands, and the work of the heart. So what do we need to, with the head, be thinking about? What do we need to be planning for? This can be, of course, something that pertains to medical care and how we are supporting the body. But Randy, as you know, dying and death is a human event, not solely a medical event. And so tending to the wholeness of the person is part of what we're doing. So when we talk about what do we need to be thinking about, sure, it could include treatment plans or anything that's happening with the bodily processes, but it might also be what are the things that we need to be talking about as a family and thinking about in support of this process. So it's a little bit broader than just kind of staying myopically with the disease progression and its process. So what do we need to be thinking about? The hands work is what do we need to be doing? What kind of things should we be executing against? So for instance, should we be bringing in the support of a palliative care team? Should we be taking a look at hospices and interviewing them upstream to understand which group might be the best fit for our family? Should we be working on projects together that can help us remember the person who is dying when they're gone? All the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about doing, the work of the hands. And then ideally, if we've done the work of the head and the hands really well, that opens up the spaciousness for the really beautiful part of a dying journey, which is the work of the heart. So as you can imagine, that's where we doulas get super excited because this is about connections and relationships and summing up and making meaning in a lot of the beautiful things that Diane talks about in Dear Death. But hopefully that gives you just a kind of general overview of what it is that we doulas are focused on in supporting our clients in their dying time.
I really love that three-part description. And listening to you, it seems so obvious to me that there's been an empty space there that doulas are filling that is different from what other people do, caring for patients or people at the end of their life. Diane, I wanted to know, what is the right time for a person or a family to engage an end-of-life doula, and who's the right person to do that, and how do you find someone?
Those are all really good questions. You know, the real easy answer is it's almost never too early to call an end-of-life doula. I mean, we find that, especially since COVID, and there's been more people seeming to be more willing to talk about their mortality, we're getting calls from people who are actually perfectly healthy, have no diagnosis, but they might want to do some end-of-life planning, or they might want to create their advanced directives. Or maybe they want to just talk through some fears or some worries that they're carrying through their life about death and dying. So that's been a real kind of beautiful part of our life and our work lately, is just that so many more people seem to be willing and open to talking about this. But truly and sadly, sometimes people do wait a little too long, and we end up getting a call when somebody might be actively dying. And sure, we can still support the family. We can show up and sit vigil, and, you know, we can be there for the client and the caregivers and everyone present. But we'll always wish that we got to meet those people earlier. And the reason that we would want to meet them earlier is so that we can have the time to build a trusting relationship, to go deeper, to have those conversations, and to make sure that our clients are at peace, that there's nothing left unsaid, that there's nothing left undone, you know, and just to even be able to talk to them about what their fears and worries might be, just to add some peace, you know, to end of life. So really, calling early is best. And I would say that most commonly, we get a call after a terminal diagnosis, soon after a terminal diagnosis. And that's great because it gives us plenty of time to build the relationship and to get to know everybody, not just our client, but as Sarah says, the entire constellation of care, so that we can pay attention to everybody's specific needs and wishes. And, you know, we just find that that really makes things so much more smooth and peaceful. So in terms of who calls us, a lot of times the client calls us directly. A lot of times it's a partner, a child, a friend, a caregiver, and more even hospice nurses, social workers, and doctors are reaching out to call us too, realizing that maybe this would be a patient of theirs that could benefit from the services of a doula. So anyone can call us. And then your third question, which was, where do you find a doula? Was that you asked me?
Yes. How do you find one?
Okay. Well, I would say probably, and Sarah would agree with this, I think that most of our clients these days are coming from word of mouth. Sarah and I have been, you know, doing this for quite a long time. So a lot of people are just still learning what an end-of-life doula is. And so once we get a client and we work with them and they see what services we offer, they're telling other people. So we're getting a lot of our clients through word of mouth for sure. But a lot of people really still don't know that doulas are out there in the world. So that also adds to why a lot of our calls come from hospice nurses and doctors and such who know that we're there. But if you are looking for an end-of-life doula and you don't know someone who's used one before, you can try a simple Google search in your area. And you can also look up the National End-of-Life Doula Alliance. We call it NEDA. And we maintain an active listing around the country of doulas in your area so that people can look it up and hopefully find somebody there.
When you look up an organization like that, are there credentials that you would look for an end-of-life doula? Or is that something that, you know, if you look for a physician, you look to see if they're board certified? Where does that stand with end-of-life care, end-of-life doulas?
There aren't any specific credentials required at this time to be an end-of-life doula. So most of the time when you look someone up, you will be able to tell if they've taken a training program. And so that's what I think you really want to keep your eyes on, is make sure that if you're going to hire a doula, that they've been trained, taken a course that's allowed them to understand all the different aspects and roles of the services that we offer. But we don't have a set credential at this point. That might change in the future, but as of right now, there's nothing set in stone.
Once you reach out and find an end of life doula, who is actually the client? Who does the doula work for? And maybe sometimes that's easy, but what happens if there's conflict between a patient and their family or different family members? How do you deal with those conflicts?
I think we get asked that question quite a bit. And I think more often than not, we consider the client to be the dying person. There are going to be exceptions to that. For instance, I have supported adult children in their caretaking of their father who was not interested in doula services, but they needed that support. So because doula work is such community work, you know, whatever toolkits Diane and I and other doulas have amassed over time, we give those tools freely to those who need them. But I would say more often than not, the primary client is the dying person. It's like you can almost imagine kind of concentric circles, right? With them really at the nucleus. And then kind of we conceive of that constellation of care almost like you do a solar system, right? Where things kind of move out a rung and another rung and another rung. But one of the things I want to just kind of emphasize or underscore from what Diane said is the reason that we tend to the needs of that constellation of care is because ultimately it's in service of the person who's dying, right? If we can make ourselves broad enough containers that we can try to understand what the needs of the different individuals are within that system, then we have a better chance of ultimately supporting the dying person and the needs that they themselves are holding. But we usually start with them kind of as the focal point and kind of go from there. Sometimes there is going to be conflict in the family, right? And I think one of the things that I talk about oftentimes with my clients in these scenarios is the dying person, it's their journey, right? So they have the agency to determine for themselves what their priorities are in that process. If a family member has a difficult kind of time getting on board, so to speak, with what those priorities look like, really, the role of the doula is to help them unpack what that resistance is. Try to help them find out where it's coming from. And while we might not get to full consensus where everybody's feeling great and wanting to sing kumbaya together, we can at least get to a point where we have respectable consensus, right? Where we can help people understand that we need to permit the person who is dying to be empowered to have a degree of agency in what that experience is. Now, if a caretaker has a real concern about these things or a loved one within that constellation, we want to support a robust, healthy conversation around that. It's not about shutting folks down. So it's a lot of facilitation. It's a lot of deep listening. And it's also some reframing, right? Sometimes people think they're feeling a certain way, but you got to go another layer deeper and you'll find out that there's something else going on there.
So does that mean that you sometimes continue a relationship beyond the death of the individual, the patient?
Yeah, and I think that's ultimately up to how the engagement is scoped and understood with, you know, each client and with the constellation of care that is there. And specifically the doula, you know, different doulas have different things that they're going to emphasize within their own private practices. We may see doulas that really focus only on the advanced planning piece, kind of that head and hands aspect of things. Some doulas who may really focus on kind of the vigil plan and sitting vigil and doing that work. And then you have generalists like yours truly, Diane and I, we kind of like to do it all. But I would say that by and large, yeah, the work of the doula really does kind of, to some degree, close up or sum up with the death. But we do tend to remain available to that constellation of care for early bereavement and giving that kind of acute support, ensuring that we don't cause what would be called a kind of secondary loss. You know, their loved one has died and now we just disappear too. So we'll stay engaged appropriately to make sure that there's that through thread being pulled. And then, of course, really taking a look to make sure that there's no complicated grief that needs additive support and connecting them to the resources that are there for bereavement and other kind of help.
What is exactly additive support? What would that be?
So really, you know, complicated grief or complex grief can be very challenging. Caregiving in particular, no matter how much support anybody receives, can have a kind of traumatizing impact to the person who is doing that work and the family members. Because as you can imagine, whatever those relationships are between people become amplified within the dying time. I hope that makes sense, right? It's like, it's how it always is, just even bigger. right? So some people may need a little support in how they process that grief afterwards. And, you know, well doulas, I think, are fantastic for affirming the experience. So for instance, I worked with a family, and it was actually for an aid in dying client, where the husband, after he died, I did what I customarily do, which is visit with his wife. A couple of weeks later, I went to see her and check in on her. And she said to me, "Sarah, did I tell him I loved him? I don't remember telling him I loved him." But because I was there and present, I was able to reassure her and affirm for her that, yes, indeed you did. So that's the kind of support a doula can offer, as compared to or contrasted with a psychologist who might be able to give, you know, real bereavement kind of help or group therapy within a hospice setting and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that sounds like a wonderful gift to be able to have had a witness to that and reassurance. And you mentioned other professionals. Dan, what's the relationship between the end-of-life doula and other healthcare professionals that are involved in this process, such as doctors and hospice workers or chaplains? How does that work?
Well, to kind of piggyback off what Sarah was just saying, you know, we have the client in the center, right? That is our priority. And then their caregivers and their loved ones kind of circling around them. And then more and more, I feel like the doula is part of a care team, kind of holding everybody. So we're working more and more with doctors and hospice nurses and social workers and chaplains and such. And sometimes I even think we're a little bit on the outside of that ring, because we have this great luxury of time. And that is what sets us apart from the medical professionals. We're non-medical, so we're there to have the long conversations, to sit long vigils, to spend the night if needed, to get to know all the other people that are in those centers of the ring and make sure that, you know, there's peace and comfort and calm and love and healing and all the good stuff kind of pouring into the client as much as possible. So that's what's really a beautiful part of our work. And, you know, sometimes that allows us to do things like legacy projects, or people are often worried about how are they going to be remembered after they die. And to be able to help a client, you know, plant a garden or write letters to their children or something like that is just so beautiful and such a privilege, and also a wonderful opportunity for us to get to know everybody and to really connect with our clients, which is why probably Sarah and I have a lot of after-death care with the loved ones of the clients as well, because we do invest a lot of our time into getting to know them and all the people that they love. So that said, you know, clearly the doctors and the hospice workers give so much support, and they do such a beautiful job really understanding that, you know, listening is such an important gift to be giving someone at the end of life, but they can't always commit the time that we can. And so that's why they reach out to us oftentimes. And so we work closely with them. And I kind of like to see myself as someone who's always taking in the big picture. Like Sarah and I will call it sometimes, we need to zoom out. And like when we zoom out, we're taking it all in. You know, we're paying attention to the client, the people in the room, the dynamics that are happening around the room. We'll be able to pay attention because oftentimes we're there more frequently. So we can pay attention to the shifts and the changes or some emerging need that might go unnoticed if it weren't for us. And then we reach out from there. We'll reach out to the nurse. We'll reach out to the social worker. If there's some spiritual distress or concern that's happening, we'll reach out to the chaplain. And so we, you know, we're grateful that we have so many wonderful people to reach out to. And I think they're becoming more grateful that they can reach out to us too and count on us to be their eyes and ears when they can't be there. It really is a beautiful teamwork when it works smoothly.
I just wanted to say, for just the way that I think of that phenomenon that Diane's talking about, it's like, that's what we doulas do. We move in those interstitial spaces.
I think as I was listening to the description, I had an image in my mind of the conductor of an orchestra who isn't obsessed and focused on a specific instrument, but can hear how they're all working together because you're listening and watching and not having any melodic line that you're solely responsible for. I don't know if that's a fair image. Sarah, you had mentioned earlier you had a client who was involved with aid in dying, and I know medical aid in dying is part of the end-of-life experience for some people in the, 10 states, I think, where it's currently legal. Can you tell us who is eligible for medical aid in dying, and what are the sort of general requirements for someone who's interested in that?
Yeah, so four and 10 states and then 11 jurisdictions, because we have Washington, D.C. too. Aid in dying is legal, and the eligibility requirements are pretty much the same. All patients must be 18 years of age or older. They should be evaluated by two physicians independently, what we call the prescribing physician, as well as a consulting physician, both of whom will come to the same conclusions around looking at eligibility factors for that patient. So the physicians must find that they think without any intervention that that patient has 6 months or less of natural life before they will die. All patients must also have the mental capacity to make the decision on their own terms with no coercion or interference from others to support them. And then they're having to make that request voluntarily, again, from their own volition. It has to be something that's super clear and kind of comes through from their voice. And then the final requirement is the ability to self-administer the medication. The medication can be taken orally as a suspension. They must be able to drink it. There are also methods of administration if folks are having trouble with the swallowing, alternative methods. And ideally in those scenarios, the person's able to self-administer in that way too. So depressing a plunger and so on and so forth, depending upon how they are utilizing different equipment to help the medication enter the body.
What is the role of the end-of-life doula in circumstances where people have chosen medical aid in dying?
The idea of being a doula for somebody who's using medical aid in dying is really, really similar to any of our other clients. We show up as a companion. We're a companion to the dying, and we're there to support them in their circle of care. So the basic tenet of what we do and how we show up is the same. But it's interesting because, you know, oftentimes people who are dying say, you know, something like, I've never died before. I have no idea how to do this, you know? And so we're there to work through that unknown territory about death and dying. But then when you add medical aid in dying to it, there's yet another component that most people have never done before. So there's several pieces of, you know, unfamiliar territory that people are getting into, whether it be the person dying or their loved ones who are there with them. So we can bring peace and comfort to the family and the person dying, but we also bring our knowledge and support. And that's very, very important with medical aid in dying, because I think the idea is to create an environment where the clients and the loved ones can experience joy and love and meaningful time together and not be worried about the medical part of it or the medication part of it or the preparation. So we show up as soon as they call us. We like to get to know people and meet them in advance, and we will walk them through what to expect and tell them everything that will happen on the day of, and we'll show up and stay there with them the entire day. And then afterwards, we'll follow through with the other people that were there, because it can be an emotional experience and something that, you know, people have a hard time maybe going out into the world after they've spent a day with somebody they love who took medical aid in dying. And so we like to be there for people afterwards, like Sarah was talking about earlier, just to be a support for that person. If you call us and there's a week or 2 weeks or more with notice before someone's going to do aid in dying, we'll try to get through as many of the same things that we'll do as an end-of-life doula with a client experiencing a natural death, which means we'll want to make sure that they've made peace with their relationships, that they've said everything they wanted to say, that if there's something that they still have left that they want to do that's important, we try to facilitate that. If there's issues around forgiveness and that sort of thing, we'll try to facilitate a conversation or write a letter or whatever we can do to let go of as many worries as possible so our clients can be comfortable and ready for that day.
Which time is there usually between the time that a person requests medical aid in dying and it actually happening? Is it a short period of time, variable?
I think generally it's about a week, it seems like. I mean, Sarah, you jump in too. I mean, right now it's legally has to be 48 hours in the state of California. And every once in a while, we'll get a client and they'll be wanting to do it in 48 hours. And then we, you know, shift our schedule and jump through hoops to make that happen. But it seems like having a week or so in advance is more common for me lately. What has it been like for you, Sarah?
Yeah. And then I just supported a client with her transition last week, and she was a client of mine for about a year and a half. So I think it can be quite variable, you know, depending upon the where we end up kind of coming onto the radar, if you will. If people know that doulas are available, they'll probably engage us as soon as they're able. But as Diane was saying, we'll jump in and avail ourselves whenever we can, regardless of what that timeline looks like, and hopefully be able to make an impact no matter what, right? But yeah, it's really variable, I would say.
Yeah. And I'll add to that just a little bit also is that, you know, we always tell people that they can change their mind at any time. I mean, this is a big decision that people are making. So we want people to know that even though they've told us they want it to be in 48 hours or a week, that we're there to support them whenever they choose. So we're not to be beholden to something that they've said to us or obligated because they've picked a day, because it is an emotional journey as well. And we want to make the space for people to change their mind and to really, really be 100% ready, or as ready as they can be when they do that.
Yeah, I was curious about that in terms of how many people who request medical aid in dying actually go through with it. Is it almost some?
Most of the clients I've had have gone through with it. I think there's a lot of peace for certain people in knowing that they can get the prescription. I think that a lot of times once somebody is qualified and it becomes an opportunity that they can avail themselves of if needed down the road, I think it does bring comfort and peace just knowing that.
Yeah, and I actually have some statistics with that might be helpful just to kind of frame this. And, you know, honestly, this data is probably about a year or two old at this point in time, but it says that about 63% of people with the prescriptions ingest the medication and die, and up to 30% of people who qualify and obtain the prescription do not take it. So as Diane was saying, sometimes just having that peace of mind can go a long way. And I think knowing that that agency exists can bring a degree of calm and peace. But like Diane, my personal experience has been if somebody pursues that path, they're probably already pretty committed to it. That's what I've seen from my lens. But those were some of the numbers behind that. I think the big thing to think through, too, is that not every dying journey is the same. Right. And so I know that, for instance, at the American Clinicians Academy on Medical Aid in Dying, Dr. Lonnie Shavelson talks a lot to palliative care physicians who may be prescribing doctors about having really rich and robust conversations with their patients around what that trajectory looks like, what that dying journey is going to be, because some dying journeys are rather peaceful and don't necessarily entail, you know, some of the challenges that another dying journey might. So again, this is really about having intentional conversations. And I think that's something where we doulas really lean in. As hard as it is and uncomfortable as it may be to ask the question of our doctors, we have a right to know what our dying journey will look like. So we can then make an informed decision about what our threshold and tolerance levels are and how we can be supported in that process just based on that information.
So leaning into uncomfortable conversations, could you tell us in a little bit more detail, like what happens on the day, and especially obviously what you do or being there, but I assume that there are people who participate in medical aid in dying who do not have the help of an end-of-life doula.
So it can be fairly variable. What we have seen is that hospices in particular, you know, ideally anybody who's doing medical aid in dying has the support of hospice on their side. And the primary reason that you want hospices engaged is because ideally they're the ones who will be able to come and pronounce death, and we can mitigate having a coroner involved in the process or the police being called, which of course is ideal for everybody involved. But beyond that, of course, hospice provides amazing support. So anytime that Diane and I meet clients, if they're not on hospice and they're within that 6 months or less prognosis, please get on hospice. And for aid in dying, definitely having your hospice team there is critical. And they provide that kind of expertise and support leading up to and day of what we call the day of ingestion. But where there's some variability is in what the internal policies are for each of the hospices on how they will lean in to support their patients on a day of ingestion. And so here in the Bay Area, we've seen a bit of variability there. There are some hospices who allow their staff to be present and on site and even mix the medication. And then there are other hospices who can't provide that level of support. So again, if we use that model of doulas kind of moving in interstitial spaces, we work with that hospice care team to develop a plan for the day of ingestion that will feel super solid around how the dying person and their constellation of care is held. So it feels like it's really, really thought through and that they're getting the support that they need. So what I would say is, even though there are people who proceed into utilizing aid in dying without the support of doulas, it's a really good idea to get clarity from your hospice team about what support they're able to provide and what support they may not be able to provide. Because if, for instance, you're working with a hospice where their internal policy does not permit their staff to mix the medication, that task alone may fall to a family member. And you can imagine that that might be a challenging thing to take on emotionally and psychologically. So I hope that kind of helps to give a sense of the variance that we can encounter. And so again, asking those questions, the uncomfortable questions, and getting real clarity is going to support everybody in having a day that feels more seamless and well thought out.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it. This is obviously tremendously compassionate work and purposeful work. I know, Diane, can you tell us a little bit about the program that you have at the University of Vermont and how you train end-of-life doulas through that program?
Well, I am one of 9 or 10, I think now, instructors at the University of Vermont. We have an end-of-life doula certificate program, which means you get a certificate when you're done, not that you're certified, completely different. So it's an 8-week online course. And usually we have about 25 students in each of our classes. And it is kind of amazing to me because short of a few optional Zoom calls, it really is all writing and discussion boards. But this intimate connection develops almost the first week with these people who kind of come in, like-minded people, curious people who want to learn how to do the work of the doula. But we also have doctors, social workers, chaplains, nurses, nurses from all types, as well as hospice nurses coming who want to understand death and dying because it wasn't talked about too much in medical school. And maybe people don't really feel comfortable being with the dying. So it's really exciting for me to see how many people are taking the class from so many different professions, aside from those either wanting to be a doula or just wanting to understand their own mortality and their own issues around mortality better. And so over the 8 weeks, we tend to get really, really close. And, you know, we go into life review, legacy work, scope of practice. We talk a lot about hospice and palliative care and how to lean into each client individually. But the key to the course is doing your own work. A lot of people come in, think they're going to get a little bit about how to be a doula or a lot about how to be a doula, but they find that they're changed because they've taken the course. And it's really important to us, and I think it was important to me as a doula myself, was to pay attention to my own shadows and my own triggers. Like I had breast cancer and my first 3 out of 5 doula clients had breast cancer. And probably had I not had a certain level of training and skill and understanding of how I might be triggered personally during those times, I might not have been able to show up as well for those clients. And I think that's the personal work that just really is the golden nugget in that class.
Is end-of-life doula care covered by any medical insurance?
So currently, no. And I think that's kind of tied back to there isn't that kind of oversight, the regulatory body that, you know, we see kind of with the medical clinicians and how that works. And I think for us to be considered as something that insurers would cover and Medi-Cal and Medicare, I think the regulatory bodies would have to move in before that could happen. And that's just not where we're at currently.
Do each of you see as like the most important next work for doulas in general moving forward?
I think from my perspective, mostly because I'm instructing the course, it's about education and consistency. I think it's really important that the doulas are trained in a way that they can be holistic, so that even if you might not want to do advanced directives or legacy work might not be your thing, you at least understand it, and that we get to work together and collaborate more in teams and our communities so that we can resource out to each other. Sarah's been doing a really wonderful job in the San Francisco Bay Area of bringing some of the doulas together. And it's really helpful, and I think going to continue to be more and more helpful as time goes on, to be able to cover our clients' needs, to understand that we can't do everything. You know, we might specialize in one thing, but let's know what the services are and let's gather our resources together in our own community so we can serve our clients holistically in any way.
Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming book? What's in it? When's it coming out? How do we get it?
Well, it's called What Matters Most, Lessons the Dying Teach Us About Living. And it's a book Maria Shriver actually asked me to write it after I wrote an article for her Sunday paper that went viral. And so it's about 30 stories of clients and the lessons that I learned being with them at the end of life and how to have a more meaningful, positive, productive life. And it was so beautiful because I got to interview about 8 of my doula friends and nurses and doctors, including Sarah. We have this quite beautiful story that everybody's been in tears who's read it so far. And it's not going to come out till next September, but it's a long process, you know, working with the publishing company. But I think it's going to be really a beautiful explanation and insight into the work that we do and the what we receive. I mean, people say, oh, you guys are angels, you give so much. We're not, trust me, but we get a lot out of our work too. I mean, it's so rewarding. And I think that being able to share some of the stories is really such a privilege.
Well, it links me back to the beginning when I talked about your experience with your grandfather and your interest in finding out how he did that so beautifully. Have you learned anything about that?
Well, if you read the book, you'll know that, yes, I've learned a lot because, I mean, every client is different and every story is different. So, you know, my grandfather, he was really humble and really kind. He worked on people with burns. So he treated serious burn victims. And I knew that he'd witnessed a lot of sadness and hardship and grief. But he saw like the beauty in everybody. He went beyond his patients and worked with families. And he was just able to really share love in a way that really made a difference to so many people. And I think like his loving heart really showed him what was most important, you know, developing relationships and just caring about humanity. So he taught me that, and along with so many other things that I've learned along the way.
Final question. What type of person is attracted to this work? And when you are looking for a doula for yourself or for your family, how do you know when you found the person who is your doula?
Yeah. You know, the thing that's so great, and as Diane was saying, we're putting in a lot of effort to gathering all doulas here in the Bay Area, and to see that range and the diversity and the different ways that people come to this work, it's really a beautiful thing to see. We tend to all have a kind of common thread of compassion and desire to serve. I think that's something that you wouldn't find somebody in the doula-verse who doesn't have those inclinations. But how we come to the work is very variable, and our different ways of approaching the work can be quite distinct as well. So I'd like to say that I'm not everybody's doula. And so the best thing to do when seeking a doula is meet a few of them. You know, go ahead and approach it like an interview and think through what feels like support for you. Different people are going to have different needs. And so maybe doing a little bit of pre-work before you even reach out about what are the kinds of things I want help with. Do I need somebody who's really going to help me select a good palliative care team and a hospice team? It's somebody who's super organized and going to kind of lean in more on the kind of thinking work, a strategic partner there and the execution support? Or am I really looking for somebody who can help me understand how to make meaning in my life? Or do I need someone who can do all those things? So really, just find the doula that resonates best with you. Because when you have a conversation with the doula that's right for you, things are going to click. It's going to make sense. it's going to feel right. If you're feeling like it's a bit of a force fit, then that might not be your doula. Maybe it's time to go and interview a couple other folks.
Well, I'll just add to that it's really important to not be a people pleaser and just say yes to a doula when this might be one of the last relationships that you really build in your entire life. And I think that's really, really important. So when I get a call, I am not automatically thinking, oh, this is my client. I'm thinking, who is this person? I want to get to know the person on the other end of the phone, because whether it's something about that person or what is most meaningful for them or where they live geographically or what they're really looking for, as Sarah was just talking about, I might not be the right person, and that's okay. So as doulas, we don't take it personally because we want our clients to have the best end of life experience as possible. So that's really a key piece. Like Sarah said, hopefully we're all compassionate. We're all showing up with the same heart-centered way of being with our clients, but we're all different. And just like we connect with different friends in our life, it's the same thing. And I think it's an important relationship to not worry about saying yes to the first person you call and to just seek somebody that really does feel like a good fit for you and your loved ones.
That's great advice. And I think that's a perfect moment to close. I really just want to thank you both so much. It's been really great. And I thank you not only for coming and talking to us about this work, but thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you for having us today.